Good evening, Truth Seekers. Malloy here on the Love AM Radio Network. Thanks for stopping by. Stick around for a while tonight, okay? I think we're going to do lots of phone calls tonight after we get a couple of items out of the way here. First of all, Diane of Florida has some a pronouncer for me. I talked about the Soviet, the Russian news agency yesterday, last night, Novosti, and it's pronounced Novosti. Thank you. And also, everybody in media is pronouncing the name of the country, or the, not the country, but the autonomous region, the province, the whatever you want to call it. It's being pronounced as Ossetia, but I am informed it's pronounced Ossetia. And this is from someone who, from Diane in Florida, who studied Russian for 2 years and lived with a Russian boyfriend for 4 years. Aha! Novosti is a Russian word meaning news, and Ossetia is pronounced Ossetia, not Ossetia, as I've been doing it and as just about everybody's been doing. So we'll go with those pronunciations. Thank you, Diana. Eva in Washington wrote that on August 11th, yesterday, Ian Welch on Fire Dog Lake blog wrote in Cutting to the Chase on Western Russian Relations, that was the title, he explained, among other things, the now forgotten fact that almost 20 years ago, Gorbachev agreed not to use the Red Army to crush dissent and rebellion in the various Warsaw Pact states if, in exchange, Pappy Bush agreed not to expand the former Warsaw Pact countries. In other words, not to convert them to NATO. And apparently NATO and the United States and Europeans did not live up to our end of this agreement in any way. No surprise there. American politicians from the United States, I think Henry Kissinger is a good example. And these people are still, like a virus, still infecting the entire country. These kind of international gangsters will say anything. It doesn't make any difference. George Bush, whose father helped finance the Nazis, telling Gorbachev the truth, and then his son following up. Oh, yeah, okay, sure. Now, I mentioned Debka file last night briefly when we were taking a look at the information flowing around the planet on the Georgian-Russian conflict. And I mentioned that Debka file is based in, I think, Tel Aviv. Maybe not Tel Aviv, maybe Haifa. But it is in Israel and is run by a father and daughter combination. The father was and maybe still is part of Mossad. The daughter was an officer, I believe I have this correct, in the Israeli army. I don't think it's reverse. I think that's the breakdown. Debka file bills itself as... We start where the media stop. And it's been my experience, although some people in the net community, in the web community, think Debka file is completely off base. I have found it to be completely on target in the 5 or 6 years that I have been accessing their information. So, you know, you pay your money and you take your choice, right? Anyway, Debka file has disclosed Israel's interest in the conflict between Russia and Georgia from its Debka files, what they call their exclusive military sources. And here it is. Jerusalem owns a strong, that would be the Israeli government, owns a strong interest in Caspian oil and gas pipelines, an interest in seeing them reach the Turkish terminal port of Sihan, rather than the Russian network. Intense negotiations, Debka file writes, are afoot between Israel, Turkey, Georgia, Turkmenistan, and Azerbaijan for pipelines to reach Turkey and thence to Israel's oil terminal at Ashkelon and on to its Red Sea port of Eilat. From there, supertankers can carry the gas and oil to the Far East of the Indian Ocean. So Debkafow goes on, aware of Moscow's sensitivity on the oil question, Israel offered Russia a stake in the project but was rejected. Last year, Debkafow writes, the Georgian president commissioned from private Israeli security firms several hundred military advisors, estimated at up to 1,000. 1,000 Israeli military advisors to train the Georgian armed forces in commando, air, sea, armored, and artillery combat tactics. They also offered instruction on military intelligence and security for the regime in Georgia. The government of Georgia also purchased weapons, intelligence, and electronic warfare systems from Israel, according to Debkafow. The report goes on, these advisors, the up to 1,000 Israeli security firm advisors, were undoubtedly deeply involved in the Georgian army's preparations to conquer the South Ossetian capital Friday. That was Diskinvali. It's hard to keep these, very difficult to keep these pronunciations coherent. Debkafow goes on, in recent weeks, Moscow has repeatedly demanded that Jerusalem halt its military assistance to Georgia, finally threatening a crisis in bilateral relations between Russia and Israel. Israel responded by saying that the only assistance that it was giving to the government in Georgia was defensive. You see, that's what the Bush crime family says about those radar installations along the southern borders of Georgia of Russia and the western borders of Russia. It's purely defensive. And Debkafow adds, this has not gone down well in the Kremlin. Therefore, Debkafow concludes, as the military crisis intensifies in South Ossetia, Moscow may be expected to punish Israel for its intervention. Well, there you have it. The early reports that I had, and I brought them out, I think, last week when we first reported on this, Friday night, the early reports were that there were, Israeli military advisors, along with American military advisors, assisting the Georgian army. And, of course, that would thoroughly piss off Russia to the same extent that if Russian military advisors and, Russian military advisors and Chinese military advisors were working hand in glove with the Mexican military to possibly invade what used to be called the Republic of Texas, you see? So. Now, there's more. CNN, according to Paul Joseph Watson, writing at Prison Planet today, CNN is airing misleading footage of the war between Georgia and Russia. And the attempt, of course, is to shift public opinion in this country in favor of the Georgians. That's according to a cameraman interviewed this morning who works for Russia Today. Russia Today is a satellite TV company in Russia. And it aired the interview on its English language news channel. The story is yet to appear on the internet, as of this writing anyway, or in any other news outlet in the United States. The Russian cameraman is saying that CNN had used his footage, the cameraman's footage of Georgian forces attacking Russian civilians in Diskinvali, the provincial capital of South Ossetia, but then claimed it showed Russians attacking Georgians in the Georgian town of Gori. So, here we go again. This time, American media, CNN, which should know better. I still believe it should know better, but that doesn't mean anything anymore. We'll have more on this as soon as we come back from the break. This is Nova M Radio. I'm Mike Malloy.
Tiananmen Square.
The Mike Malloy Show. It's you are now entering a flying monkey free zone.
It's exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there.
21 past the hour. So anyway, back to this this charge by a Russia Today satellite TV company cameraman that CNN is using his footage, a footage that he shot of Georgian forces attacking Russian civilians in Tiskin Valley, the capital of South Ossetia, and then claiming that it showed Russians attacking Georgians in the Georgian town of Gori. You follow me there? Okay. Now, Russian officials are saying that the Georgian assault on Tiskin Valley is an act of genocide and a war crime. And eyewitnesses there, according to the Russians, say at least 2,000 civilians were murdered by the Georgian military. And as Prison Planet reports, the fact that Georgia, backed by the U.S. and Israel, was responsible for the provocation that led to the Russian response, that fact has been buried by the majority of Western corporate media. Well, we've been talking about that. And again, that charge might be a little bit iffy at this point. Nothing is ever what it seems in either the Middle East or the Caucasus, for sure. But all the reports I've heard so far have only lightly alluded to the fact that the Georgians felt froggy and decided to jump, which provoked the Russians, as well it should. I mean, given the global state of affairs, why not? Why not be or feel provoked or threatened, even if you are Russia, especially if you are Russia, after having been treated like the red-haired stepchild by the rest of the planet for the past 20 years, even to the point of not being allowed to be a member of the G8 or the G7 until a very late date. Russia used to just be included in the talks while the Russian natural resources and the economy and what was left when the communists were lost power was being devoured by the so-called oligarchs that were being taught how to destroy and privatize an economy by Americans, Brits, French, anybody that could go there. There was all kinds of money to be made in Russia, all of it by theft, deceit, lying, cheating, stealing from the Russian people. So, who's to blame this ex-KGB agent, Vladimir Putin, for being extremely pissed off? Look how his country, rightly or wrongly, look how his country, the direction of Russia, right or wrong, over the past centuries, look how it's been treated in the past 20 years. Smacked around, kicked to the curb, laughed at. And of course, during that time, Putin or Gorbachev or any of the renegade, if there were any, Russian military commanders who couldn't stand what was going on, couldn't stand the fact that they had a drunk in charge of things for a while, Boris Yeltsin, what stopped renegade Russian military officers from just saying, screw this, and launching some of their missiles? What stopped them? Well, that's something I think that we'll never know. Maybe the mutual assured destruction theory. So Russia, in a sense, just had to take it. All the smacking around, all the denigration, all the vicious laughter and attacks about ha 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 ha, capitalism won, socialism law, like a bunch of goddamn schoolyard bullies, the rest of the world dancing around the corpse of the Soviet Union. And a lot of people in the West said, well, it's damn good in time, they should have ended a long time ago. Well, so should have predatory capitalism a long time ago, right? And a more gentle socialism with a heart to replace both systems that were in effect or in place in these two empires, the United States and the Soviet Empire. All that to say that I think anyone can understand Putin's rage. I think he truly hates George Bush, especially with the condescending comments that Putin had to take about Bush being able to look into his soul. I'm sure Putin, when he heard that, said to himself, whatever the Russian equivalent is to, what the F is this jerkwad talking about? Look into my soul. If he looks deep enough, he's going to see a pistol pointed right between his eyes. But Putin had to suck it up. See, he had to put up with it on the global stage. And now this happens. Russia has been pushed around and pushed around, and Putin reacts. Why is anyone surprised?
Doing talk radio right. From the left, it's more of Mike Malloy.
26 before the hour. Okay, all right, for what it's worth. Andrea writes in, Mike, I don't know what is the right way to pronounce Ossetia with English accent, but in Russia we call it Ossetia, not Ossetia. So you were right calling it how you did yesterday, Ossetia. Sorry, I lived in Russia for 20 years before moving to this country. Just wanted to point it out. Okay, Andrea. Ossetia, Ossetia. All right, where were we? Oh, yeah, back to the Russian cameraman in CNN. As Prison Planet has been reporting, and I think we mentioned this on this program too, a prime example of U.S. media bias in shielding Americans from the responsibility the Republic of Georgia has to take for the carnage is the fact that, as Prison Planet points out, outlets like the BBC continue to report that thousands of civilians were killed in Georgia, with the obvious inference being that these are victims of the Russian onslaught. But these victims were not killed in Georgia. They were killed in Ossetia by Georgian forces. And it just goes on. Now, today, you probably know, I'm sure you know, Russian President Dmitry Medvedev ordered an immediate halt to Russia's military operations against Georgia. He was quoted as saying, the purpose of the operation has been achieved. The security of our peacekeeping forces and the civilian population has been restored. Yeah, yada, 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 yada. Now, back to the CNN cameraman. The city of Gori was said to be about to fall under the control of the Russian army, but the cameraman says a video actually was shot in Tiskin Valley, which had been flattened by Georgian shelling. That's the reason it looks so horrible on the video. His name is Alexander Zhukov. He's from the Rossiya Al-Yaum channel. He said, quote, when we arrived and news came, and news came that Gori was being shelled, he said, I saw my footage. I said, that's not Gori. That's Tiskin Valley. Having crawled through the length and breadth of Tiskin Valley, I don't need much to tell from which point this or that footage was recorded. I can swear in front of any tribunal. I can point at this location on the map of the town because I and the cameraman of the other Russian channel videotaped it. All right, we all know that the first casualty of war is truth, but so there you go. Another example. Now, for CNN to borrow video and not credit it, A, B, to mislabel what is being seen on the video is almost beyond belief for me, especially at CNN International, which is where so much of the reporting of this crisis is being conducted. In 2000, when I moved back here from Chicago, I went to work for CNN International, and one of the absolute requirements that we had as writers and producers was to make absolutely certain, there was no wiggle room here, that whatever video we used would be fronted or identified as AP video, BBC video, CNN video. Oh, if it was CNN video, we didn't have to identify it as such. That was just a given. But whatever video we used, we had to identify the source. And God help the writer or producer who allowed a video presentation to go on the air that didn't clearly state where the video was shot truthfully and when. If, for example, the way I remember working at CNN 8 years ago, this video would have been labeled Russian video, gory, August 10th, without, we never put the year on, August 10th, or Saturday. So something is completely out of kilter here. When I came back to CNN, I was also informed, and I've mentioned this before several times. We used to joke about it in the lunchroom. I was also informed that CNN now had two, possibly three CIA employees who were working at CNN as a writer, producer, supervising producer. And, of course, I said, yeah, who? And the skinny was, well, we don't have any names. We just know, because somebody in personnel or somebody someplace, you know, put the word on the floor. You're being watched, folks. So, you know, you can take that or leave it. It really is immaterial when one considers that the reporting of the news in this country is totally skewed to satisfy corporate interests anyway. If CNN is now, has either joined that cadre of liars or is in the forefront of that cadre of liars or whatever, it really doesn't make any difference any longer because broadcast media is in the toilet. It's gone. Forget about it. It's there for entertainment. It's there for soft news stories. It's there to report on the Olympics. It's there to talk about murder and mayhem and this person strangled and that one hanged and these bodies found in a suburb of Chicago and just crime. It's like cops. It's like 24/7 of cops. Or if you're really crazy and you want to watch some of the political crap like Chris Matthews or, oh, I don't know, whoever. But as far as a news source, television is dead. It cannot be believed any longer. And that didn't happen with this story. That's been a gradual process over the past, what? Pick a number. 20 years, 25 years, 10, 6, 4, 3, 9, 19, 18, 32. Pick a number. But here's the bottom line. If you get all or most of your news from television, then you are grossly misinformed. You are being lied to. Your brain is being carefully and calculatedly scrubbed. And you couldn't find your ass with both hands if required to. If you were told to follow the instructions you got on television, you better get away from it. As far as entertainment, movies, and the History Channel, and yada, 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 the History Channel, right? As far as any of that, it's wonderful, great, okay. Oprah, The View, I don't know, Who Wants to Be a Model, blah, 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 blah. But as a news source, you're drinking poison. You are drinking poison. If television news is your primary news source. And that means 80% of Americans are drinking poison 60% of the time when they want news. That's pretty scary, isn't it? That's frightening. Uh, The agreement that Russia said it would adhere to today, Dmitry Medvedev said he would. You know, the guy who has absolutely no power in Russia. Putin has some power. But he said Russia had punished Georgia enough for its aggression against the separatist enclave of South Ossetia. And so they now have a six-point agreement. The Georgians had endorsed it in an earlier draft. They will withdraw, the Russians will, and the Georgians withdraw their troops to the positions they occupied before fighting broke out last Thursday. The agreement says there will be unfettered access to humanitarian aid. Both sides will cease the use of force in South Ossetia and Abkhazia, the second disputed territory, and begin the process of negotiation over the future of the two breakaway enclaves. Medvedev said at a news conference with Sarkozy of France today, quote, I think these are good principles to settle the problem, to end this dramatic situation. It is up to Georgia now. Now, as New York Times reports, if the ceasefire takes hold, Russia will have pulled back from a confrontation that threatened to draw it into a Cold War-style conflict with Western nations. And then I like this line. Listen to this. This is Ellen Berry and Thanasis Kambanis writing in the New York Times wrote this. A great goal. This is not written as commentary, not that I'm aware of. This is written as news. A great goal has already been accomplished, colon. Russia has asserted its ability to wrestle its neighbors to the ground at will and, if not now, then later, resume its old role as the hegemon of the South Caucasus. Doesn't that sound like something that William Crystal would write? A great goal has already been accomplished. A great goal? Great? Adjectives? You're not supposed to use adjectives. A great goal has already been accomplished. Russia has asserted its ability to wrestle its neighbors to the ground at will. Neighbors, plural. And resume its old role as the hegemon of the South Caucasus. So what the New York Times is saying here, that Russia will now begin the process of culturally devouring all the nations that at one time were either part of the Russian Federation, or the Soviet Union, or the CIS, or was it CSI? It's just unusual, I think, isn't it, to find that kind of comment in a news article in the New York Times. Maybe not.
Monkey Right Blues, here's the cure, Mike Malloy.
We were young together. It's about 10 before the hour. All right, we're going to take some phone calls starting at the top of the hour. The phone number here is 800-989-1480. So if you would like to get in the queue now, that would be great. 800-989-1480. I guess it's time to stop talking about the Russian-Georgian situation, right? This is just round one, and there will be more. There is no question there will be more. The degree to which there will be tension as a result of this, international tension, and even more shooting wars is, who knows? Who knows? So, if you have a comment on it, fine. If not, that's okay, too, because there's a lot of stuff going on here in the States. The Attorney General presented to the American people in the U.S. Senate by Democratic Senator Charles Schumer. That would be Michael Mukasey. That attorney general today rejected the idea of criminally prosecuting former Justice Department employees who illegally used so-called litmus tests in hiring their hiring decisions. He said he had already taken strong internal steps in response to what he calls a painful episode. Two internal investigations found that what was going on, if somebody didn't profess enough deep-seated belief in our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ and George W. Bush, not necessarily in that order, and the Republican Party, and the fact that liberals or progressives or Democrats were nothing more than the spent spawn of Satan, then they were not to be hired. Now, of course, this is not the way the Justice Department is supposed to work, but the way the Bush crime family has operated, every single department is not the way they are supposed to work either. But in a speech this morning to the American Bar Association, no less, in New York, Mukasey acknowledged that some critics and commentators, you like that? Not the American people, not the Constitution, not the rule of law. Oh, hell no. Some critics and commentators have called on the Justice Department to take what Mukasey called more drastic steps in dealing with the scandal, including, oh no, prosecuting those at fault and firing those who were hired through these flawed procedures. Get rid of them because they now have civil service protection. These are the worms. These are the termites who will be there waiting for the next Democratic president. The one that you, some of you folks think, whose feet you're going to hold to the fire and get him to be a liberal. Ha ha, ha ha, ha ha. Meanwhile, in the Justice Department, in the State Department, in the Treasury Department, in every single department of this corrupted, almost beaten to the ground government, lie these worms, weasels, skunks, termites waiting, and they can't be fired. And they were put there specifically to lay in the weeds and wait for President Clinton or President Obama. But never mind. We have a plan. We're going to hold their feet to the fire. And anyway, Mukasey says, not every wrong, this is a quote to the American Bar Association, not every wrong or even every violation of the law is a crime, end quote. Well, be a son of a bitch. Not only does this Mukasey creep, not only has he decided not, here's another one, to not uphold his oath of office, to not uphold the U.S. Constitution, to not uphold the rule of law, not only that, but this weaselly bastard has decided that he has taken the place of the woman with the blindfold holding aloft the scales of justice. He will determine, through some extraordinary power, guilt and innocence, crime and no crime. He will decide. He will decide whether or not every violation of the law is a crime, even though, by definition, it is. But then again, freedom is slavery. War is peace. Justice is, well, whatever in this instance Mukasey says it is. How do you like that? Huh? How do you like that? Now, who confirmed Mukasey? Let me think for a minute. Gosh, this is tough. Was it Democrats or Republicans? Who let this rat bastard into the Justice Department? Think, Mike, think. Who was it? Yes, that's right. It was Democrats. Who could have said no? Who introduced him to the Senate, to the American people? Think, Mike, think. Was it a Democrat? Was it a Republican? Who was it? I got it. It was Charles Schumer, the senior Democratic senator from New York.
Yes, but Mike, we have to vote Democratic this fall. Think of the Supreme Court. Ah! We'll get Obama in and we'll hold his feet to the fire. That's what we'll do. We will, Mike. We will.
Not every wrong, and not even every violation of the law, is a crime. That should be carved into some building facade somewhere in Washington, D.C. Wouldn't that look nice? Not every wrong or even every violation of the law is a crime. Welcome back. It is about 7 past the hour. Regular listeners to this program know that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is something we talk about a lot on this program. Also, the influence of AIPAC, the pro-Israel lobbying group, and its influence, specifically its influence on U.S. foreign policy decisions, is also a frequent topic here. There is a new organization, a lobbying organization called J Street. It is relatively new. We'll find out in a moment how new. It is a pro-Israel, pro-peace movement. The executive director of J Street is one Jeremy Ben-Ami. He was the deputy domestic policy advisor in the Clinton administration and policy director for Howard Dean's presidential campaign. A little background. In mid-July, J Street released a comprehensive survey of American Jewish opinion on American politics and U.S. Middle East policy. The survey tried to gauge the pulse of the American Jewish community on issues such as the Arab-Israeli conflict, the Iraq War, the Christian Zionist movement, and the prospect of intervention in Iran. And as the press release says, the poll reveals a remarkable gap between the attitudes of American Jews and the conventional wisdom about how Jews view America's role in the Middle East. Instead of holding the hawkish, hardline positions often expressed by many established Jewish organizations and leaders, American Jews, as a result of this poll, demonstrate overwhelmingly that they support assertive, peace efforts and an active U.S. role in helping Israel and the Arabs resolve the conflict. Joining us now is Jeremy Ben-Ami, who is the executive director of J Street. Thanks for taking the time to come on the program tonight, Jeremy.
Oh, great. I really appreciate the opportunity to connect with you and your listeners.
Let's talk about these items, that first of all, that are listed in the release as a result of the survey that you took, the American Jewish community's attitude on issues that start with the Arab-Israeli conflict. How is it different from, say, what AIPAC or most American politicians present as the American Jewish position?
Well, I think the most important distinction is that it seems American Jews are actually capable of having more than one thought at a time, and that thought is, we don't necessarily need to solve every conflict with military action. And that seems to be the sort of philosophy of the neocons who have run American foreign policy for the last 7.5 years, and certainly a line that is pushed aggressively at times by folks who are either, for instance, from the Christian Zionist right, like John Hagee and Christians United, or some of the more extreme spokespeople from the American Jewish community. So we find that that's the most striking answer we hear all the time whenever there's a conflict, is, well, we need to beat them, and, you know, we need to exert military force and take on Iran, take on Iraq, beat Hezbollah, beat Hamas. It's always a military solution. Turns out that the American Jewish community actually understands that military strength and, you know, military power is actually only one tool in the toolkit of a nation's foreign policy, and that you can actually have diplomacy, you can look for peace, you can find peace to be part of a plan for security. And that's runs throughout all of the questions that we ask, that American Jews recognize that a final agreement between the Israelis and the Palestinians, for instance, is an absolutely essential component to security for Israel and to the national interest of the United States.
To what degree, and I would think it is a matter of degrees, to what degree is there a difference in opinion between American Jews and Jews in Israel, Israeli Jews, regarding the Palestinian Israeli question where it concerns the use of force? I think everything that we have seen in that conflict from the Israeli Jewish perspective has been coupled with the use of force. In other words, if the entire region looks like a nail, all of a sudden you realize that you have a hammer, or however that expression runs. What's the difference between American Jews and Israeli Jews in their sense of what is just for the Palestinians?
Well, I think for Israeli Jews...
All right, Jeremy, you're breaking up horribly. Can you hear me okay? You're completely gone. Ian, if you can put him on hold, Ian, and talk to him and see if you can get him on a landline or something, because I really do want to continue this conversation. You want to try to bring him back? You want to see if... no, okay, he's going to call in again? Okay, all right. Jeremy Ben-Ami is his name. If you're like probably 99.9% of Americans... You've never heard of J Street. They are at jstreet.org. Just the letter J. Street spelled out. jstreet.org. And it is a group that is determined, I think, at this point, to present itself as a face different from that of AIPAC, where it concerns... American Jews in their lobbying efforts regarding these issues that we were just talking about, whether it's Iraq, Iran, the Palestinian question. And that is the reason I think it's important for us to, for Americans to get to know J Street. Let's bring Jeremy back on now. I think we have a better connection now, Jeremy.
Apologies about that. Hopefully you can hear me better now.
Yeah, all is well. All right, the difference in American Jews and Israeli Jews in their take, their ideas regarding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Well, you know, I think there's a much more robust debate in Israel than there is publicly in the American Jewish community. That's one of the most startling things, is that, you know, in the parliament in Israel, or in the newspapers, and even at dinner tables in Israel, you'll find a very robust debate between people who are on the right, people who are on the left, and they all disagree. I mean, that's the nature of politics. It's the nature of a tough situation. Everybody thinks something else is the right answer, and at times people hold two views at once and argue them both. Here, the problem is that the debate has been so constrained, and then if you dare to sort of dip your toe across the line and start to criticize either the government of Israel or the government of the United States, and you say perhaps the things that are being done are not in the best interests of Israel or of the United States or even of the American Jewish community, you immediately get labeled as an anti-Semite or somebody who doesn't care about Israel, and it has this impact of constraining the debate. So I think to us that's the most notable difference between Israel and the United States. When it comes to what the opinions actually are, you know, the interesting thing about both groups is that you can muster a majority of people to support a peaceful approach to ending the conflict, and you can muster a majority of people to support a more belligerent approach. And the question comes down to one of political will. Where is the political leadership going to take the people? Because people just there in particular just want the conflict to end. They want some security. They want to be able to raise their kids in peace. They don't want them going off and dying and being blown up. And it is not the vision that they have for their future. And they just want it to end at this point. And if somebody can come along and promise them it'll end through peaceful means, they'll back them up. If somebody comes along and says we're going to end it through military means, they'll back them up. So I think you'll find people of two minds, both in Israel and here in the United States.
There was an article, and I'm trying to find it as we talk, an article just within the past few days, I think it was in Haaretz, that it was an opinion piece. It wasn't news. It was definitely an opinion piece, but it made the or it stated the proposition that Israel has now become an apartheid state because of a recent action by the courts in Israel to uphold laws passed by the Knesset that, in effect, force on the Palestinians second-class citizenship. I realize that's a cliche, but I think we all know what we're talking about here. So is it J Street's position that Israel has become an apartheid state? And I have to take a break here, Jeremy, so let me leave the question hanging until we come back. Stick around, I hope.
Sure,
okay?
Yeah.
All right, we'll put you on hold. Our guest is Jeremy Ben-Ami. He is the executive director of J Street, the political arm of the pro-Israel, pro-peace movement. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Tonight, how much he hates these people? It's more of Mike Malloy.
Twenty-one past the hour. We're talking with Jeremy Ben-Ami, who is the executive director of J Street, the political arm of the pro-Israel, pro-peace movement, and is presenting itself to the American public. I believe this is correct, Jeremy, as an alternative to APAC, the American-Israel Political Affairs Committee. It was in Haaretz. It was written by Amos Shokin. And what he has written, Jeremy, is that the citizenship law makes Israel an apartheid state. And he's referring to, it occurred in June, the Israeli government's decision to extend the validity of the citizenship law for another year. Shock and Rice is evidence that the legal barriers preventing severe discrimination against Israel's Arab citizens and harm to their civil rights have been removed. So, in other words, the severe discrimination and harm to the civil rights of the Arab citizens of Israel can continue. What is J Street's position on that?
Well, I'm not familiar with the specific article or with the specific exact law that he's talking about. I mean, clearly, you know, there are a number of things that are going on both within Israel and in the territories that Israel is occupying that provide for a different set of treatment of one group of people versus another based on their background and their religion. And it's justified for security reasons, but it results in a two-tiered state. And some people would define that as being apartheid. Others would say that that word is too loaded. We don't take a position on the use of the word. We simply want to see Israel stop engaging in activities that are counterproductive to its own interests. So when Israel puts into place a system of 650 checkpoints, of which hundreds of them do not provide any marginal addition to security, or Israel continues to expand settlements or to not take down illegal outposts that it has promised to take down and builds a system of roads on the West Bank that are for Jews only, and they carve up the Palestinian territory. All of these just add up one after another into a set of steps that, as a whole, really end up being counterproductive to Israeli security, which was the reason for doing it all in the first place. They are creating another generation of Palestinians who are only going to want to get even with Israel for these violations and for this treatment. And in the long run, it doesn't make Israel more secure. It makes it less secure. And so we're concerned about this from the vantage point of a group that does care about Israel, that isn't looking to simply vilify it and rake it over the coals, but to say to it, how are you going to have another 60 years? How are you going to survive and be secure and ensure that kids don't end up, you know, for the next three generations continuing to go into the army and have to occupy another people and have families, you know, hurt by terror and all of the rest of the bad things that do happen? Are you going to get through another 60 years through perpetual conflict, or are you going to get through another 60 years peacefully if you finally end this conflict and resolve it and actually reach an agreement with the Palestinians? Our view is you only get through the next 60 years with an agreement. The window of opportunity for that is unfortunately closing rapidly, and we believe we need an American intervention and American action to help bring about an end to the conflict now, or it's going to be too late.
Yeah, American action would be certainly a change from what has gone on for the past almost 8 years. A two-state solution versus a one-state solution, I think the demographics of a one-state solution would mean that Israel would become, would end being a Jewish state, which, of course, it is now. A two-state solution, those who advocate a two-state solution, I believe, always reference the 1967 borders and the end of the settlements in the territories that exceed those borders in 1967. Is it the position of J Street as a lobbying organization to accept the idea of a return to the 1967 borders, or is that something that is just off the table at this point?
No, I mean, that's the starting point. You know, we believe that that is the outline. It was the outline of the Clinton parameters that were on the table at the end of 2000, at the end of his administration. It's the parameters that were used in the drafting of model peace agreements like the Geneva Accords. It's the starting point for the discussions that are going on right now. There was a report today that Prime Minister Olmert has put on the table, an outline that starts with 93% of the territory being returned to the Palestinians, and then a land swap with land adjacent to Gaza being being given to the Palestinians so that they approximate 98% of the total territory of the West Bank. It's, you know, a likely scenario that you won't get a deal unless you get to 100%. I mean, the bottom line is that all of the territory that was part of the West Bank and Gaza, at least in gross terms, will have to be returned to the Palestinians, although the exact territory may vary if some of the major settlement blocks are kept by Israel, then other land will have to be swapped for it. But
Jeremy, I have to break again. Can you stick around through one more break?
Sure.
Okay, because there are a couple more things I think folks would like to hear about from the position of J Street. We're talking with Jeremy Ben-Ami. He is the executive director of J Street, an organization, a lobbying organization, that is positioning itself as the non-AIPAC Jewish lobbying organization in the country. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Bedtime lullaby. It's Mike Malloy.
Riders on the storm. 26 before the hour, we are talking with Jeremy Bonomi, who is the executive director of J Street, an organization, a lobbying organization that has some positions diametrically opposed to those of AIPAC, the more well-known lobbying organization for the state of Israel in this country. Let's go back to these questions that were in the press release sent out by Jessica. Jeremy, if you don't mind. The Iraq war, or no, let's come to that later. The prospect of intervention in Iran, there's been an awful lot of severe, if not saber rattling, certainly missile rattling and invocation of nuclear weapons in an attack on Iran by either the United States or Israel or both. What is the position of J Street on the Iranian question?
Well, we were really out front this summer in our clearly sending a signal from this part of the Jewish community and our friends that we absolutely wanted to be clear that we are saying no to war with Iran. And we launched an online petition that got 35,000 signatures, actually, at jstreet.org, which is our website. And the petition said specifically that we want to have diplomacy first, and we want to see active engagement by the United States and a real effort to put some carrots on the table along with the sticks. And the policies that have been followed, as you know, in this administration and that are rattling around in Congress are very often just focused purely on the most militant and saber-rattling approaches. We would like to see a diplomacy-first approach. We're very glad to see that actually some of the resolutions that were introduced into Congress came to a grinding halt this summer, not just from our pressure, but also from other organizations that have made it clear to Congress that the country's just not in the mood for another misadventure on the Middle East front. And, you know, the resolution, which had been expected to pass easily, calling for a naval blockade of Iran, actually has come to a complete stop. And Robert Wexler from Florida, Congressman Wexler, who's on the House Foreign Affairs Committee and is endorsed by J Street, wrote a very big piece in the Huffington Post outlining what it would take for him and some of his colleagues to sign on to any sort of further legislation relating to Iran. And he led it, of course, with diplomacy. And I think there really is the beginnings of a sea change happening in Congress and a willingness to recognize that they have got to stand up, at least in the last 6 months, finally, of this administration.
I don't mean this next question to sound confrontational, but what is the diplomacy involved in telling a nation that it shall not develop nuclear weapons? Israel is not a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Iran is. Iran insists it is not building nuclear weapons. It may be, but the insistence is that it is not. Its partners in the building of these centrifuges, which seem to be both Russia and China, are also insisting that these are not designed to produce weapons. So what sort of diplomacy is Congressman Wexler or J Street or anyone, what sort of diplomacy is required here to tell a nation that has signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty that it may not continue with its nuclear program?
Well, I mean, there's no, there won't be an argument from anybody who's associated with J Street with the perception that there is a serious threat posed by Iran to both Israel and to the neighborhood. And so, you know, we may disagree on that, but, you know, we would start with the notion that President Ahmadinejad himself is not, you know, the sort of leader that we believe has a place in the community of nations, and we don't think that the type of threats that he has put on the table and the Holocaust denial and number of the other things that he has done, and I'm not blaming the entire regime, and I'm not blaming the people, but he himself is, in fact, a threat and is somebody that we need to figure out how to marginalize.
But isn't he already marginalized? He is not a head of state in the sense that Olmert or Bush are heads of state. The real power in Iran rests with this council of mullahs who make the decisions. Ahmadinejad is a smartass who's out front a lightning rod, and I honestly don't believe, and I'm curious whether or not you believe, that the people who really rule in Iran, not to mention the citizens of Iran, would ever want a confrontation with Israel. They're not interested. Ahmadinejad may be making these half-witted statements, and some of those statements depending on who's doing the interpreting, have perhaps different meanings. But he's not the man with the power in Iran. Do you agree?
Well, I think what I would agree is that the situation is complex. I think you're underestimating the power that he does exercise. He certainly has set the economic policy of Iran over the last 4 years, and that's the policy that has driven their economy into the ground. So he had enough power to put into place his economic program, pass it through the legislature, and then watch the Iranian economy crumble. So, you know, he does have power. It is associated with the office of the president. There are some very major decisions that he cannot make alone, but to say that he is not, that he's simply a figurehead and, you know, that he doesn't have any power is, I think, overstating the case. What I think the United States has been missing is the fact that there is a complex political dynamic in Iran, that there are opportunities for us to exploit divisions there. There are political rivalries. There are different power centers. And diplomacy means using the, you know, traditional approaches to trying to exploit your rivals and those with whom you have conflicts to exploit the divisions within their side. And that's what we would mean by engagement and diplomacy and exploring opportunities. But we would not deny that Iran, that there is the potential for a serious threat, that Iran is, in fact, the source of the weapons and of the armaments that are flowing into the south of Lebanon, that Hezbollah is a client state, that the Syrian approach to Israel is funded and supported by Iran, that there is an Iranian influence in the region that is hostile to and negative towards Israel and poses a threat. So we would not deny that.
So the
question is how best to deal with a threat like that. Do you use an intelligent foreign policy that tries to exploit the weaknesses of your enemy, or do you feed right into their worst traits? And that's what the United States has done on the current path that it's on, because it only makes Ahmadinejad actually look sane when the United States talks about attacking Iran.
So all the more reason for truly, not to use this as a cliche as it's used, but truly constructive engagement with the Iranians.
Right, exactly. You've
certainly got your work cut out for you, don't you, Jeremy?
It's a very there's definitely a challenge here. Some people say we're pushing a boulder uphill. I like to think we're actually kicking a pebble downhill, and it'll gradually gain momentum and grow in size as it becomes larger and more unstoppable.
I sincerely hope J Street accomplishes what you are apparently setting out to do, because the whether they're misapprehensions or not is kind of beside the point at this point in U.S.-Israel history. There is a widespread belief among non-Jews in this country, and I'm sure you're familiar with this belief, that U.S. foreign policy to a great extent, if not totally, in the Middle East is dictated by the desires of the Israelis, and that the Jewish voters in this country have become nothing more than the hallelujah chorus behind the Israeli government. Now, whether that is correct, incorrect, partly correct, mostly incorrect, I mean, across the entire spectrum, it is a conception that non-Jewish Americans hold. And I guess that is one of the reasons your organization is trying to operate against that. Is that a correct assumption on my part?
Well, it's definitely one of the things that we who started J Street feel it's most important to have this type of an organization is that for the sake of the American Jewish community and for its future, this isn't just about Israel. And we think, you know, there's a much more constructive set of policies that Israel could be following to reach peace and that peace equals security. And it's not just about the United States, because we also think U.S. interests, the strategic interests of our country, could be better served if we actually were playing a constructive role in the Middle East instead of a destructive one. But it's the American Jewish community in the long run that actually is going to bear the brunt of this. And whether I would disagree with the perception that you present, the fact is that that perception is out there.
Right.
And that perception is taking hold, and that perception is going to only grow and the more that a very limited sector of the American Jewish community sets the agenda and the tone by which the entire community is judged, the more likely it is that things like anti-Semitism and a communal sense of being held accountable as a community for this set of policies, that becomes more and more likely, and it is one of the reasons we felt it was important to start up J Street.
Jeremy, we're out of time. Again, I'm intrigued by what J Street's all about. I hope you folks succeed, because I think anything less than success after all the conflict and all the tension in the Middle East, anything less than success is going to be worse than failure.
Well, I really appreciate that, Mike. I hope your listeners will check us out at jstreet.org. We really need people to sign up on our email list. We have 60,000 people already, and the size of our list will really show that we speak for
the majority. All right, Jeremy, let's talk again. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, take care. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
Left out by right-wing talk radio? You found a home with Mike Malloy.
Ten before the hour. Eric in Los Angeles has been holding on here for about an hour. Eric, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi. Yeah, great interview with J Street, because, if we don't get peace over there in that part of the world, half the world could catch on fire.
Yeah,
so I'm glad to wait while you interviewed that guy.
Okay.
But anyway, you know, talk radio, right-wing talk radio really had a field day about a week ago when Barack answered that seven-year-old girl's question and said America is not what it could be, America's not what it used to be. But it turned out that he was strangely prophetic in what he said, because just a few days later there was proof positive that America's not what it used to be. There was confirmation when our client, our satellite over the Georgia, cowardly struck that capital in the middle of the night and inflicted murder and terrorism. It's just murder, and the whole world knows it, on the same morning that the Olympics started in Beijing. And it's just unconscionable. It's just murder what he did. And then at least when the Russians counterattacked the next day, at least people knew there was a war going on. But he struck in the middle of the night, and there were a few dozen Russian peacekeepers there, but it was to maximize civilian casualties, and leveled half the city, and the terror to the people and the children. It's just murder. And then, if I can say one more thing, and then Bush says the greatest thing that Russia's doing wrong is they're trying to replace this president, our client. We've got 150 or 200 military trainers there, military people. Israel's got 1,000 in Georgia. And anyway, it was prophetic what he said. America, we've turned to the dark side. Is that what America is? A bunch of murderers?
The leadership of the United States at this point, I think, would certainly qualify for the title killers, war criminals. We allowed that to happen. I'm trying to be gentle when I say that, because on December 12th, 2000, when the United States Supreme Court stopped the vote counting in Florida and said that to continue the vote counting would be damaging to George W. Bush. And at that point, when the American people sat back on its collective ass and did nothing, absolutely nothing, the Supreme Court of the United States intervened and stopped the counting of votes to determine who was going to be president of the United States. And when the smoke cleared, of course, when recounts were held after Bush was sworn in, it was very clear that Al Gore had won that election. Well, aside from all that, the Bush crime family and its supporters took deep notice of the fact that they just stole an election and the American people did nothing. So from that point forward, there was no longer any need whatsoever to adhere to the law, the Constitution, international treaties, nothing. Because the Bush crime family completely understood that there would be absolutely no resistance. Now, the demonstrations in this country prior to his ordered assault and occupation of Iraq stand out as more of an aberration. I think those demonstrations surprised everybody, the media, the Bush administration, and even the people who showed up. I know it damn sure surprised me to see 300,000 people show up in Washington to protest the war before it was launched. But again, it was all ignored. Because at that point, after stealing the election and shoving America's experiment with representative government right into the crapper, the Bush crime family understood they could do anything. So are we led by killers? Absolutely. Are we led by war criminals? You betcha. And the ultimate responsibility, Eric, is mine and yours and everybody else in this country who has allowed this to progress for almost 8 years. There is no way possible for us to dump the responsibility on Pelosi or Reid or Cheney or Bush or anybody. It's because we the people have allowed this to continue, and there is no other way that I know of to look at the situation.
And Mike, an idiot knows that when you do something wicked and evil, and then you try to cover it up, it just makes it a lot worse. And that's what they're saying now. Oh, that Russia had started and they bombed some villages. I mean, that's a lie and they know it, you know. I mean,
well, as far as lies are concerned now, it anything that comes from American media, American government, or 90% of whatever allies we still have left on the globe, and that's not very many. What came out of the Blair government in the run-up to Iraq were lies and deceptions. What has come in so many instances from the Israelis have been lies and deceptions. What has come from what other allies do we have? Jesus, that's about it, isn't it? Isn't that about it? The UK and Israel. Who else? Think, Mike. Think quick. Who else? South Koreans, what have they said lately? You get my point, I hope. The lies and deceptions by our puppet in Georgia, in the Republic of Georgia, shouldn't surprise anyone. Look at our puppet in Afghanistan. Look at, where else do we, look at our puppet in Iraq. Look at our, well. You get the point. All right, we have a break here. When we come back, we're going to take your phone calls. So if you're not on, hold, now would be a good time to get there. The phone number is 800-989-1480. You won't have a real long wait tonight because we're going to take your call. 800-989-1480. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio. Well, I guess we're going to use that for the third hour open tonight. We have some gremlins in the equipment. No big deal. 7 past the hour. Welcome back to the Molloy program on Nova M. As promised, let's go right to your phone call, starting with John, who is in Miami, listening on WINZ. Hey, John.
Hey, how you doing, buddy?
I'm all right. How are you?
All right. Great show. Listen, the reason I was calling is because it's my opinion, and probably maybe yours or many other people. The Israelis and the Americans are involved in this attack by the Georgians on that part of the country. And I think it has to do with testing Russia. They want to test Russia to see if actually Russia would do anything in case they decide to actually attack Iran. So I think it's just basically a test. And unfortunately, because of this test, thousands of people, like in Iraq, have died. I think they've got their answer that Russia will do something. And I think they're probably now kind of tentative about whether to actually do something about Iran or not. I don't know. What do you think your opinion is on that?
Well, first of all, the reports, and I know they're true, of Israeli, let's call them paramilitary or private contractors involved in military training being in Tbilisi, being in Georgia, are correct. The reports of U.S. military personnel being in Georgia are also correct. We mentioned last night that one regiment or battalion was sent from the Atlanta area of combat American soldiers who had been in Iraq and were then sent to Georgia for, quote, training, end quote, before they were redeployed to Afghanistan, which is insane. But that's the kind of stuff we read in the Atlanta paper and go, oh, really? Oh, okay. But having said that, I don't know to what extent the Israelis and the Americans had prompted the Georgians, the Israeli military or the American military or the Israeli paramilitary had prompted the Georgians to attack. I don't think there was so much of that involved as the prodding of this the president of Georgia, Saakashvili, into believing, prodding by Cheney and these neocons and members of the Bush crime family, prodding Saakashvili into believing that he was going to be defended by NATO or the European Union or America, the United States, if he did something as criminal and stupid as launching a military invasion of Ossetia. So I'm suggesting here at this point, John, is that we not jump to any conclusions about who was the trigger. Before I would look to the U.S. military or the Israeli paramilitary or Russian adventurism, I would first look to what I know to be a group that starts wars for the sheer hell of it, and that is the inner circle of Dick Cheney and this Bush crime family.
Oh, I agree.
Right, and beyond that, who knows? But was it a test of see how Russia would react? I don't think so. I really don't, because the two areas, the Caucasus and Iran, may be definitely connected because of oil, as is Iraq, as is the entire Middle East, as is the entire area of the Caspian Sea area, Central Asia. It's all connected because of this insane, murderous lust for oil. While they're all interconnected, the attempt is to, by the Bush crime family, is to isolate Russia. It has always been the attempt. And eventually, if things go according to plan, for American oil companies to get their hands on Russian oil. Don't forget that Russia has an enormous reserve of oil. That's what's made Russia so wealthy. That's why they are now doing what they're doing. They are not the impoverished country that they were back in the late 80s, early 90s with the breakup of the Soviet Union. They are not that anymore. And Putin is saying enough. He's saying enough. I've had my ass pushed in my face enough. Now I'm going to start reasserting myself as the leader of Russia. and that Russia is a force to be reckoned with, whether it is in Europe, whether it is in the Middle East, whether it is on the global stage with these damned Americans, wherever it is. What Putin is saying is, I'm back. You understand what I mean with that, John?
All right. Listen, keep up the great work, Mike.
All right. Thanks a lot, John. Appreciate you checking in. Ulan is calling from Helsinki, Finland. Ulan, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, Mike. It's Alan.
Alan, I'm sorry. I always get it wrong. I'm sorry. Alan,
no,
hi.
That's okay. Good morning. Good morning from the future, Mike.
Yeah.
This Georgian situation, as you know, for our listeners there who have some geographical issues, we're right next door to them. And I think that this Georgian story, it's somewhere in the middle of what is being reported. I mean, you've got CNN, you know, with its propaganda, and then you have Channel One from Russia with its propaganda. And probably the story, like you've been saying, is that Shakashvili has been pushing a little bit too much. And, of course, you know, Raisin Brain had to go to China to kiss Hu Jintao's gluteus maximus. Because of all the debt that they've been holding. So in this game of chess, Medvedev pulled a move, and Raisin Brain was, you know, exposed.
But wait, if you're suggesting, Alan, that Medvedev did anything without the express written orders from Vladimir Putin, I don't agree with that.
Well, okay, I guess I did a bad job. No, of course. I mean, Putin pulled the number, but okay. I think we all need to take aside how we might look at things and look at how the Russians look at things. I mean, you know, the EU is right on their border. And
I agree. Absolutely. Yeah. NATO is attempting to absorb what were former Warsaw Pact nations. There is no more use for NATO than there is a use for the carbuncles on our elbows. And the Russians are just tired. They're pissed off about this.
Absolutely.
You know, they had their country half eaten alive by the shock therapists who came in when Soviet communism collapsed and installed this predatory capitalism that was just an absolute outrage. It's payback. It's payback by Putin, and I wouldn't be surprised. As a matter of fact, I fully expect that Putin is going to do all sorts of things to reassert Russian power.
Yeah, I would keep an eye on the Baltic states as well. I mean, there were riots in Estonia last year. There are at least a half million Russians who live in Estonia, and there were huge riots because they don't feel respected. So, I mean, the call could go back to Moscow, and depending on how the relations are between the two countries, you know, he could easily pull a move there. And, of course, the EU is going to yell and scream, but at the end of the day, they're really not going to do anything.
No, and, what can the European Union countries do? I realize a couple of them.
Freeze bank accounts? Nothing.
Well, they can't even do that because the retaliation by the Russians would be a cutout. Look what happened to, Ukraine, when Ukraine started feeling froggy. And the Russians immediately cut off their energy sources.
Yeah, that's right.
There is so much, or I should say, there are so many European states that are dependent on oil and natural gas that either flow through the Russian pipelines or are actually brought to the surface by Russia at Russian wellheads. That the European Union can't do what, you know, Europe doesn't have any oil. They have nuclear power and what's left of the North Sea oil fields. And
Norway is running out of oil as well.
Well, there you go. So there is, and I think since we are still insisting on being a carbon-based civilization, global civilization, the Russians understand they have a loaded gun and the rest of us have pop guns. And all they have to do is start pulling switches and shutting down valves, and the economies of 50 nations grind to a halt. Hey, Alan, I have to leave it there. Thank you. I appreciate you checking in. Take care, okay?
Okay, you too, Mike.
All right. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M. Thank you.
because life's too short to listen to Right Wing Radio. It's more of Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. Mike from Connecticut writes, I know you're not talking about this topic, but I just heard Bush ordering the Democrats for an up or down vote on offshore drilling. Up or down vote. Record-setting filibusters by the Republicans, and they want the Democrats to give in and vote for offshore drilling? You know something? Not only will they give in and vote, but they will approve it. Mike in Connecticut. Well, you know, I hope not. Bob Herbert, writing today in the New York Times, wrote about the what he calls the latest smokescreen in this presidential election, and that's the bogus contention that lifting these restrictions on offshore oil drilling would somehow bring down the price of gasoline for American motorists in, you know, in the foreseeable future. Americans, you know, we really are dumbasses at heart, though. We really are. We're just such an ignorant collection of freaks that offshore drilling is going to make a difference in our precious price per gallon of gasoline at the pump. What Herbert's talking about is McCain especially told these cheering bikers at that rally in South Dakota, we're going to drill offshore, we're going to drill here, we're going to drill now. And then when he was in Lafayette Hill, Pennsylvania, he said, we have to drill here and drill now, drill here and drill now. Jesus Christ, what is with this senile old bastard? Now, with McCain and the Republicans painting this false portrait of drilling as a method of release, or relief, I should say, for today's oil prices, guess who has jumped on the bandwagon? Now it appears Barack Obama has eased off his previous opposition to new offshore leases. So as Bob Herbert writes, and so dies the possibility of the presidential campaign offering any real clarification of this important issue. We should know this. Herbert writes about it. It'll be nearly 10 years before any oil at all would be realized from new offshore leases. 10 years. So your adorable 7 or 8 year old would be just about 17 and asking for a license when this new oil started coming online. Maximum capacity from these new leases wouldn't be reached until 2030. That's when your 7 or 8 year old is approaching age 30, finished with college, very likely married with children. And even then, the amount of oil expected to come from these leases would have little or no effect on the price of gasoline at the pump. Here's what the Energy Information Administration, the statistical agency that provides official data for the federal government, had to say about the anticipated additional output from offshore drilling. Quote, because oil prices are determined on the international market, any impact on average wellhead prices is expected to be insignificant, end quote. Do you understand what Herbert wrote today? Do you understand what the people have been saying about this abominable offshore drilling scam? Who is going to benefit from this? Please, Jesus, God, for once, America, wake up. The oil companies. We get nothing out of this. Nothing. Nothing. But 63% of respondents to an ABC News poll want the embargo on new offshore drilling lifted. Drill! Drill! What about the risk of serious environmental damage to U.S. coastlines over the next several decades? And the fact that all the drilling will have zero effect on prices at the pump. Nothing. As Herbert writes, I wonder if the electorate will ever wise up. We've known or should have known since the 1970s that the day of reckoning on energy would come. The U.S., blessed with so many resources, is no longer blessed with an abundance of oil. And then he adds, how pathetic that in the midst of a presidential campaign, the loudest voices we are hearing on this subject are crying, drill, drill, drill. And McCain, I mean, what a slug. What a halfwit. What a panderer. I mean, it's astonishing. And to you Barack Obama supporters, your man is now saying the same damn thing. What does that mean about change? What does that mean about change? Huh? Man. Don't you get tired of this? Don't you ever just get so tired of this? All right, we have a break coming up here fairly quickly. We'll take your phone calls. We'll take your phone calls when we come back. This offshore oil thing is just it's just driving me crazy. It's like, I don't know. It's like the whole village turns out. You know, the village, everybody turns out and they go stand on the edge of the cliff and they look back at their village and they start screaming, yeah, let's burn it. Some little kid says, but why do we want to do that? Just for the hell of it. Let's burn it. Let's burn it. Come on, let's burn it. Come on, folks. At some point, we got to wake up. Honest to God, we got to get out of this nightmare.
Show, because each time you listen to Right Wing Radio, God kills a kitten.
Twenty-six before the hour. Barry writes that Obama is not blindly for offshore drilling. I don't think I said that, Barry. Barry writes he's open to discussing it, and then he quotes Obama, who says, quote, like all compromises, it also includes steps that I haven't always supported. I remain skeptical that new offshore drilling will bring down gas prices in the short term or significantly reduce our oil dependence in the long term, though I do welcome the establishment of a process that will allow us to make future drilling decisions based on science and fact, end quote. Those are weasel words, Barry. Those are weasel words. Those are not the words of someone who has presented himself as being an agent of massive dramatic change. I'm sorry. I realize from what you wrote that Obama is your candidate. And then Barry adds, based on science and fact, not corporate profits. Referring to Obama's statement, a process that will allow us to make future drilling decisions based on science and fact. That will happen, Barry, the day that the oil industry is nationalized, or the day after the oil industry is nationalized. Surely you don't for a moment believe that profit is not the sole driver where it concerns the oil industry. Don't email me and tell me you believe that. So the day decisions are made in a key industry, hopefully a soon-to-be non-existent industry, but a key industry such as oil production, when those decisions are made based on science and fact, drilling for that resource are based on science and fact, will be the day that the oil companies no longer exist and the means of production rest in the hands of the government. You do understand that. And again, in my own defense, I did not say he mindlessly supported offshore drilling. I said his position is changing. He's wavering. And to use the kind of weasel words that Barack Obama is using now on issue after issue, if it's not upsetting you and you are an Obama supporter, then you, I'm afraid, you leave the realm of being an Obama supporter and enter the realm of being an Obama true believer. Just like the people who supported Reagan, like the people who support George W. Bush, as few as they are remaining. Back to your phone calls. Kathleen is calling from Austin, Texas. Kathleen, welcome to the program.
Hey, Mike. I'm not going to talk about him, I promise.
Say what?
I'm not going to talk about Obama tonight, I promise.
Okay, that's cool. Whatever you want to.
Yeah, I know. No, I wanted to talk about how I just don't understand these people that want to go to war. I mean, you've got the religious type with the end of days, and,
right.
And then you've got the Islamic ones who think they're all going to go to heaven, and so I can understand those people. But the Saakashvili, I just read his biography, and the man is incredibly intelligent, and I mean he has degrees from Columbia and George Washington and places
uh-huh.
in France and every place, and I saw him interviewed, and he's incredibly smart. Now, why in the world did he think that he could go poke the bear? And there
I think the quick answer is he thought that the United States and the European Union, or the United States and NATO, would back him up.
But he's so smart. How could they back him up?
Well, then it follows that he was told that he would be backed up.
Well, I guess the point I'm saying is that the man is very bright, and as I said, I read his Wikipedia page, which in many ways is, you know, but it sounded pretty good. And
right.
You know, so he has an incredible education, so he would know, because you say, okay, they'll back me up, but how can they back me up? And I mean, this is a man that has sat down and you know, been in the politics of the Caucasus and with Russia, and you know, they see enemies coming out of every crevice in the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And then also you've got the people, you know, you've got the Israelis and the one, and they're running around trying to get everybody to go bomb Iran. Why? I mean, this could lead to World War III. Well, what's going to happen to them? I mean, that's what I don't understand. Cheney probably has a bunker all prepared where he can just go down, you know, to 26 floors and, you know, and live out the rest of his life. But we could have World War III, and these people are smart enough to understand that. What happens? Is it some kind of gene that turns, you know, some kind of mental thing that turns off the minute you get into power that says, all of a sudden, you know, that I'm these wonderful things are going to happen? These are smart people. I don't understand it, Mike.
Well, I don't either, Kathleen. I have no more of a grip on this than you do. I don't know that I agree, though, that so much that Saakashvili is a smart man simply because he has graduated from prestigious universities in the United States. So did George Bush.
No. If you read he really is smart.
Is he? I've not read
interviewed and everything, and that's the point. Is that at some point the intelligence he has? I mean, he has accomplished a lot of things. He's no George Bush. At some point, that just went out the window.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he just went someplace else. But
well,
I mean, that's
then,
my feeling anyway.
Then the only you know, I've tried to think about what would make a man like Saakashvili attack an area populated by Russians, knowing that Russia and his country have been on the verge of a shooting war for about 10 years now, mm-hmm. if not longer. I don't know what makes a politician do that.
Mm-hmm.
Hubris, stupidity, relying on non-existent partners who have been provoking you in the shadows, saying, yeah, go ahead and attack. Don't worry, we'll be right behind you. Go ahead. Attack. We'll be right behind you. You know, you've got the full support of the Israelis and the Americans. And I don't know where that idea came from. I can see the United States pushing them into it. But why would the Israelis give a damn? The Israelis are interested in a flow of oil, yes, like I read earlier this evening. They have an interest in pipelines that would go through Georgia as opposed to Russia. But beyond that, to push Saakashvili into what is essentially an attack on Russia,
right,
is insanity. Unless he was told by the people whispering in his ear, which would be people that work for Dick Cheney, that the Russians would not respond, that the Russians would be too afraid to respond because of retaliation by the United States and possibly NATO. And if Saakashvili was ignorant, stupid, whatever, enough to believe that, then all of a sudden now he knows. You know, McCain said the other day, McCain was peeing in his own hat, standing there talking about, we're all Georgians today. The hell we are. We're not. What does that mean? So who, you know, what freak said to McCain, get out there and say, as a show of solidarity with the Republic of Georgia, that we're all Georgians today? But please, you know, 90% of Americans couldn't give a crap less about what happens between Russia and Georgia. And there's McCain. Oh, we're all Georgians today.
Mike?
Yeah?
Well, no, just one little thing about that. It's funny. I was watching the CNN, and they're walking. They still have this huge statue of Stalin in one of their cities.
Well, he's from. He is a Georgian.
I know.
Stalin was from Gori,
right.
The city
exactly.
of Gori.
They have this huge statue of him.
Right.
And you kind of go, what kind of country? I mean, Stalin was the worst mass murderer in the entire history of the world. And they still have this statue of him in their city? How can they do that?
We name streets and highways in the United States after Ronald Reagan, too. Hey, I got to leave there. Kathleen, thanks.
Thank you, Mike.
All right, I'm glad you called in. Thanks a lot. We'll chat again. It's just global madness. We you and I, Truth Seeker, have got to get to a point. I don't know how we do this. I honestly don't know. We have got to transcend this. We have got to rise above all of these wars and rumors of wars and all this weird interplay, like the whole planet is going mad because deep in our collective unconscious, we realize that we have totally and absolutely destroyed our nest to the point where it's probably irretrievably broken. It's just a matter of time until the air catches fire. But, you know, maybe that's the unconscious realization. And so up here in the conscious realm, we're just acting like insane people. So here's what you and I have to do. Somehow we've got to learn to float above this and see the humor and just give it the old cosmic laugh. The insane bubbling of the id, just let it all go and find the humor. I'm trying. I swear to God, I'm trying. Before the hour, thanks to Ian Huff, who engineered the program tonight, Billy Foster, our technical director, Ben Birch, the podcast manager, our creative staff is Bob Alexander, Bridget Wolf, Sharon Gordy, and the executive producer is Catherine Day. Back to your phone calls. Mike is calling from Portland, Oregon, listening on the internet. Hey, Mike.
Hi, Mike. First of all, I want to say you're my hero.
Oh, no. A hero is nothing but a sandwich, pal.
Yeah, but when I first discovered you, everything you were saying was ringing
true. Well, I'm just glad you're a listener. Let's
yeah.
get to that. Okay.
Yeah. I just wanted to raise the question of whether or not, well, I meet a lot of people that think Bush is doing what he's doing throughout the world with the control of energy and all this for the United States. Maybe that's part of the fight that we have, is educating these people that they're after their own interest. But you bring up the point of nationalizing oil.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just say, for example, oil was nationalized, and our leader, whoever that might be then, was doing the same things like Bush, you know, try to control the resources and all that throughout the world. Would that then be okay?
No, and I don't think that would happen in the first place. Anyone who, or any society, civilization, nation state at this point, who understands that oil is like bad heroin. It is a drug that is making not only all of us sick, it's making the planet sick. It's causing wars. It's causing death and destruction in country after country, whether it's Nigeria or Venezuela, or Pakistan or Afghanistan. It doesn't make any difference. It is a vile, putrid substance. If it is nationalized, if the oil industry were nationalized in this country, and then a phase out over a period of time, a phase out, a support for alternative energy research, whether it is hydrogen fuel cells or any of the just so many power sources that are available to us on this planet. If that, I think, would be the result of socializing or nationalizing or a socialist approach to certain key industries, among which is the oil industry or the energy industry. It has to happen. It has to happen. As long as it's in the hands of private enterprise, so-called, as long as it's in the hands of corporations, there is going to be murder and mayhem and destruction and death and intrigue and invasions and occupations and slaughter, and ultimately for nothing. And I mean that literally, because
right,
ultimately it devours the entire planet.
But why is it that we understand that and the corporations don't? I mean,
because
they're
run
by people too.
Right, the corporations are run by people, but don't forget a corporation is nothing more than a paper construct sitting in a courthouse somewhere. The people who run the corporations, this is what they hide behind. Well, it's not me, I'm just the CEO, I could be fired or hired tomorrow. It's the people who own stock who determine what's going to happen. So maybe it's time for Americans to dump stock. Maybe it's time for Americans to say enough. I don't want to die in my own waste material. I don't want to die because I can't breathe any longer.
Right.
You know, I don't know. You ask questions, Mike. They're the same questions I ask. I have no answers. None.
Right. Right.
I do the same thing you do. I ask these questions. I wrestle with this. It drives me mad. It's insanity.
I'm just thinking that we're at that point of evolution where we're not really quite there yet. You know, it's kind of painful to incorporate that change. But still, I understand completely that it's necessary. And energy is obviously a necessary, thing for everyone. And it's a competition right now. We're in that phase of evolving into maybe a different, but we're not there yet, different source of energy.
Yeah.
So that's where, with all this conflict. Now, with that said, I mean, I've heard everything you say rings really true. The only thing that I always try to get from your show is what exactly can we do, you know, to change this? Us individuals, truth seekers, I should say.
I've said many times, and maybe it needs to be restated, this program is not about finding solutions. It is not. Talk radio is not structured that way. University think tanks, think tanks not connected with universities, intellectual organizations that focus on problems. That's where problems are solved. There are no solutions that I have ever heard on this program, either from me or from any caller. The function of this program is to clearly state what the problems are, because American media does not allow those problems to be clearly defined. And if we don't know clearly what the problems are, so to speak, then there is no way that they can be worked on and that solutions can be found. But they're not going to be found on this radio program, Mike. It's just not going to happen. Not tonight, not next year, not ever. So, but I understand what you're saying. I wish I could tap into some source that had solutions. But I think anyone who is in media that does talk radio, talk television, newspaper columnist, whatever, who says he or she has a solution to the problem, is either a fool or a liar, or thinks you're a fool. It requires deep thought by an awful lot of people and focused thought, not where you have to stop every 8 minutes and do a commercial. You know what I'm saying? I'll see you tomorrow night, folks. Take care. Thanks for hanging out with me tonight. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio.